All right, well, it's time for another NWR book interview, and I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, your host and author, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Mr. Steven Rodriguez. Hey, Steven.
Hello, humans.
So you may know Steven by his nickname and his longtime internet handle, Windy Man. And before we get too deep into memories of yesteryear, I thought maybe that'd be a good place to start, because as long as I've known you, going back to at least the year 2000 or 2001, I've known you as Windy Man. So can you talk about where that nickname comes from?
Yes, the origin story, a very necessary thing for any superhero. Mm-hmm. But it's actually kind of a three-pronged thing that all came together. And it really started, I would think it started in the arcades. You know, I was an arcade junkie growing up. There was an arcade that I had to walk past every day coming home from school. So I was, you know, spending lots of hours and lots of money in the arcades. And a lot of games I was playing, like pinball games and NBA Jam, because I'm very good at video games, I was always getting, you know, high scores and everything. And, you know, I'm putting my initials in. S-A-R, Steven Angel Rodriguez. But I was kind of tired of always putting in the same initials. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to clown around and just put in some other initials that aren't, you know, not my name, but I could easily identify with anytime I put my initials in. So, yep, that's me. So I just kind of thought about it. And I was like, you know what, I'm winning. I'm a winner. So I just put in W-I-N. Hmm. Win. And that was kind of my thing for a while. So I stuck with that for, you know, a couple of years. And then later on, as I was going through, junior high and high school, I started learning some things about local culture, like the local Indian tribes. And Simi Valley, California, it's where I live. It's where I'm from, I learned along the way that the word Simi, S-I-M-I, is a word derived from an indigenous word referring to the local climate, specifically the white wind clouds in the area. And it's a valley that's sort of along a major kind of mountainous corridor. So it's very windy in Simi Valley a lot, which is kind of why the city is named what it is. So there's the win in the arcades. There's the fact that I live in a windy city that isn't Chicago. And there's also the clincher, which is, you know, hey, wait a minute, I like the wind. I mean, that's something I've always liked it, you know, the breeze and the feeling of it and just the general feeling of like that. I thought that's already cool. So I just kind of put all three of those things together in a way that flowed off the tongue very nicely, and that eventually became Windy Man. And that's not my name, it's who I am.
Yes, I remember lots of little slogans and things that you would throw out into the chat room back in the very early days of the website.
Oh, yeah.
And I found a quote from yourself on your staff profile, which no one has looked at in years. Nobody's looked at any of these for years, but they've been a kind of a secret resource for me in doing the book research. And yeah, there's a quote on your staff profile on the site that says, "Respect the power of the wind," and it's attributed to
Damn
Windy
right.
Man.
Right.
It's attributed to Windy Man. So I like that you put your own quote on your profile.
Yeah, you can't see it, but you can see what it does.
Yeah, so another fun quote that I found from the website, just as a preview to our conversation here, is from the NWR Staff Moments of 2006. I don't know if you remember this article, but this was kind of an end-of-the-year roundup kind of summary, and 2006 was a big year for Nintendo by any account. A lot of major Nintendo DS games, and more importantly, the launch of the Wii system.
It
was the year that you became director of the website as my successor. And your quote here is, "My best moment was either the day I started as director or the day before I was asked to take over the job. I haven't decided yet." I bet you've decided now, but maybe we should kind of build up to that topic.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. So obviously that's a big reason I wanted to talk with you, Stephen. I mean, you were around the site in the early days for sure. And that's, you know, that factored into why I asked you to become the director eventually, is because you had been around a long time and I felt like you knew everybody and you knew the way things were done at the site. But I guess I think of you mostly as kind of like a mid-era person, because that's when you really took a more prominent role, or at least mid-2000s. You know, I don't know what the middle era of the website would be defined as, but mid-2000s. But before you worked for Planet GameCube, and then before it became Nintendo World Report, you worked at another pretty prominent Nintendo website, especially back in its heyday. And could you talk about how you got involved there and what that was like, and what carried you over from that into our site?
Yeah, so you're talking about Nintendo Nation. It was one of the original sort of Dolphin, you know, before GameCube was codenamed Dolphin. Mm-hmm. And then it was one of the original Nintendo Dolphin rumor / news sites. You know, there were a couple of them out there. Obviously, GameCube successor, Planet in 2000, that was, you know, Billy's baby. That's kind of where the whole thing started. And there was another one that I liked going to a lot, which was Dolphin Cove. That was Fran Mirabella's site.
Right.
Actually, I like Dolphin Cove so much because they actually had some solid info, and I remember printing out every single article that he wrote, pretty much. I had a little stack of papers, and if there was nothing new, I'd kind of go back through that, like, ooh, information. So that was good times. But specifically, I liked Nintendo Nation. Well, before it was called Nintendo Nation, it was called Nintendo Next. Was the original name of the site.
And
I kind of liked it more than the other guys because it looked nice. I mean, there's no beating around the bush about it. It was a prettier website, I thought. Especially these are, you know, 1999, early 2000 websites.
Right.
So web design was still pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked that site a lot, and it also had if I recall, it had like a shoutcast stream so I could listen to video game music. And, you know, forums were pretty active too. So I just, okay, I'll just go to this site more than the other sites and hang out in the forums. You start to get to know people. And the website, Nintendo Nation, was run by the notoriously big-eared Canadian Don Allen. We always give him a hard time over the size of his ears anytime he posted a picture of himself. And, oh, he hated that so much. So, of course, people would continue to do it more and more. But you know how that goes, the internet. So, as most of us do, we just hang around enough to become known in the community. And there came a point where the website had a mailbag. They called it the Q&A, that people could submit questions, email questions, or through a form. They wanted to know something. They communicate directly to the person who ran the site. And probably about once a week or once every 2 weeks, he'd update the mailbag. But a lot of the people in the forums complained that he didn't really update it frequently or consistently. So I don't remember exactly what happened for me to eventually start working for the site, but I do remember that it was suggested, or I suggested, that, you know, I could probably update it more frequently than you could. And one thing led to another. And then starting in March 2000, it came upon me to begin to update the site's mailbag. And I did that the next day and the next day and the next day. And I don't know, looking back, how I did this, but I basically updated it every single day for a year straight.
I was reading Nintendo Nation back in that time. I don't know that I would consider myself a fan of the site. I had a lot of problems with with Don Allen.
Oh, sure.
I didn't like his reporting style, and he had a lot of theories about what Nintendo was going to be doing with the system that I thought were really sort of baseless and just wishful thinking. A lot of team ups with Apple and stuff like that, 15, 16 years before that was even a something that anybody would have really seriously considered.
But he's right. There was Miyamoto on stage at the Apple
Yeah.
press conference.
Eventually he was right. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I definitely thought that he had the best looking site. There's no doubt about that. I mean, just the graphical design and the layout of it was head and shoulders above pretty much anybody else's. But I remember, Stephen, when you took over the mailbag, it was a marked improvement. I mean, I thought that the quality of the answers and the thought that was put into the responses was, and obviously the consistency with which it was updated, were all just much improved. And that's really where I got to know you first, was before you were involved in Planet in 2000 or Planet GameCube. I knew you from Nintendo Nation before that, just as a reader. And I probably even wrote to you a couple times. I don't know if you remember that, but it's very likely because I used to write into the Nintendorks daily reader messages. Is that what they were called? DRMs? So they had like
Oh,
a,
right,
they basically
yeah.
had a mailbag, daily reader comments, the DRCs,
That's
I
right,
think.
yeah.
I wrote into those all the time and talked with those guys, Brandon over there. And I probably wrote into you sometimes too, because, I was running basically an N64 site at the time, but I was interested
Yeah,
in
the
these new
informant.
systems. So I was reading a lot of these different fan sites and trying to interact a bunch.
Well, right, and I don't remember you specifically. I mean, I can check because I basically have the entire, NNQNA archive on my hard drive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I know that Michael Cole, TYP, and Carmine Red, two current Planet GameCube or Nintendo World Report staffers, including you, they wrote in too. And if you'd like, I can read you a couple of their questions that they sent in back in the day.
I would love that. I don't know if they'll love that, but I would.
Carmine's questions they were pretty technical, and really because this was the pre-launch, pre-announcement, that all we had is the code name, and we knew the system was coming. There was a lot of questions about the technical specs of the system. Is it going to be more powerful than the PS2? What about the Xbox? What's the RAM? They wanted to know this stuff,
Right.
and I mean, honestly, I knew as much as they did. But I want you, it's still important that if people ask about it, you answer them with the best of your abilities, and just the fact that people are responding to your questions, that's a really good thing for the people, because like, oh, this person, this website cares about my question enough to respond to it. You
Like
know, that.
the responsiveness itself was a service for people, right? Just the
Exactly,
interaction,
yeah.
the knowing that someone is alive on the other end of this message, and that, I know for me, especially writing into Nintendorks was probably my favorite website of that era. The thrill of seeing my name appear on that website that I like so much, the idea that I could fight through some kind of vetting process and get and like be rewarded with my name appearing in print on the site. That was very exciting. And then also, if I could say something that would get kind of a humorous, like if I could make someone laugh, if I could make the writer say, "Oh yeah, that's a funny question," or "I never thought of that," or like any kind of like personal kind of response was very exciting.
Absolutely. And that kind of spirit carried over in when he ultimately became director. But we'll get to that. Right now, I want to give you a question slash letter slash correspondence that Michael Cole, the younger plumber, sent me on September 30th, 2000. So this is 16 years ago.
Yeah, no, he would have been, I would say, probably about 15 at the time.
Yeah, and I think I w what was I?
Not much older.
I was 18, 19 by then.
Yeah.
So I'm 3 years his senior. So he writes, okay, have you ever heard a song on the radio and thought that would make a great song for a video game? I just did with "Beautiful Day" by U2. Which game? Credits for the next Mario game, believe it or not. Its lyrics sound like It's great now. Everything is now fixed. Has this ever happened to you? Signed, the younger plumber. And then I responded, I skip over the for a video game part and leap right to the wouldn't this song make a great video game? You can put any song in a video game and get away with it. Parentheses, PlayStation developers did. But some songs have the tempo and energy to almost be their own games. That might sound strange to you, but you might not have the same passion for music and games that I do. To this day, I still regularly play rhythm games, so that makes sense to me.
Yeah, well, it's funny that some of your earliest correspondence was about video games and music, because I think you and TYP are two of the most hardcore people I can think of.
Or, you know, and Ty Sugar.
Well, yeah, and Ty too. But yeah, I mean, I know you. I've had the chance to ride in the car with you and Michael both quite a bit around LA during E3 times, and you guys both are always playing video game music in your car, which is not something I would ever really even think to do. But yeah, you guys are just work. Associated with you so much.
Oh yeah, I mean, I still regularly listen to OC Remix radio at work. There's so – like I have a bunch of MP3s on my hard drive. It's like, oh, there's the radio station. Well, I'll just put that on, get some work done. Mm-hmm. It just keeps you going, you know?
Yeah. Lifelong passion.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's fantastic.
Let me see. There's one more I want to read here. Let me see really fast. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, last one. This is also from TYP. October 7th, 2000. You know, I was playing Star Tropics for NES the other day. Like you said, past compared to present can be funny. We were wondering what Dolphin would be like, but all we needed to do was play Star Tropics. There are three magical cubes in the darn game. When I got to that part, I burst out in laughter. I mean, Star Cube was almost the name of the system. Yeah. And it was.
Yes.
Actually, it's probably a big coincidence, but a funny one at that. Signed, the younger plumber.
That's great. He's totally right.
Oh, man.
If they'd gone with the Star Cube name, maybe we could have gotten a new Star Tropics game after all those years.
And we would have been named Planet Star Cube.
Yeah, maybe it's best that it didn't happen.
but yeah, they're on my hard drive, so I'll see if I find any from you and privately.
I bet you could. I bet you could. just before we move on to how you transitioned over to Planet GameCube, what did you take away from the experience working with Don Allen? You know, what made you want to leave that site? What was your working relationship like? I mean, can you make any kind of comparison to what you experienced later?
Well, it's different now. I mean, back then it was completely kind of a new thing, this whole Nintendo website business. But for the most part, Don and I were kind of separate. I didn't really do any news updates for the site, and obviously he didn't do any of the mailbag stuff. There was a time where he actually went to Japan for Space World. We were trying to figure out if I could go along too, but that didn't work out, which would have been obviously amazing for me at the time.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of hack the site a little bit to post some news updates while he was away. But, for the most part though, he did the front end and I did the Q&A and, some stuff in the forums, and basically I was the community guy, all told. But the thing was, is that I didn't really leave by choice, because about March 2001, March, April or so, that was, I think, one of my last mailbags at the time, the site was basically closed because Nintendo Nation was one of the websites that was involved with an affiliate network, a company by the name of eFront.
Oh, my gosh. I forgot about eFront.
Yeah. So it was
a scandal.
Yep. So the Penny Arcade was involved with that. Something Awful was involved with that. And Nintendo Nation, of course, as well. The bigger sites were fine. We weren't. And that was it. That was the end of Nintendo Nation.
Yeah. So you were there all the way through the end.
Pretty much.
So do you I have a memory of this period that I'm very ashamed of, but I'm happy to bring it up because I'll own up to my mistake and try to be a grown up about it. But I remember finding out probably on the NeoGAF forum, or maybe our own forums, when Nintendo Nation shut down. And I knew that it was related at the time, at least. I knew that it was related to the eFront business, even though I didn't really understand what that was all about. But I remember putting up a news story on Planet GameCube that basically was celebrating the death of Nintendo Nation. Because
I gotta look for this.
Yeah, oh, it's definitely still up on the website. I found it before. Just like, did I really do that? I mean, how could I have been that immature? You know, why would I celebrate someone else's failure? And really not even failure, but really just kind of tragedy. Because, you know, ultimately, I don't think it was Don's fault that the site ended.
Oh, no.
You know?
No, it wasn't.
I think he was duped by some bad people and some bad stuff happened that was really beyond his control. But, you know, at the time, there had been some rivalry, as there was some degree of rivalry with almost all of our competitors, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So the sense that, you know, we're all fighting over the same sources, the same screenshots, you know, the same events. We're trying to get the best interviews. We're all fighting over limited numbers of review copies, for instance, that might be sent out to different websites by that time, and or certainly after the GameCube launch. But in particular, I didn't like Don because, again, I felt that he was actually kind of spreading misinformation. And to me, that was a capital sin in the business that we were in. You know, I got into writing about video games because I wanted to clear up bad rumors. I wanted to set the record straight on things that I thought were easily proven or very clearly argued to be false. And I wanted to kind of make sure everybody had the right information so they could have their discussions and their arguments or their theories or whatever, but have that solid base to start on. And I don't know why I felt this way. I don't remember the details this long after, but I had this feeling that Don was just kind of making things up a lot of times. And this would have been especially in the mailbag before you took over. So this would have been going back, this beef that I had with him would have been going back quite a while by the time the site shut down. But yeah, I wrote an article on Planet GameCube basically kind of celebrating it and saying, you know, I'm glad this place is shut down because I don't think they give very good information. And it was maybe a year or two later or something like that. I started to think of, I mean, I'm probably felt some regret about it pretty quickly after, but I certainly, a couple years later, I saw Don Allen reappear on NeoGAF on the forum.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
He was posting about who knows what, and I saw him on there, and I was like, wait, is that the same guy? Because I hadn't heard from him since the site got shut down. And I sent him a message, and I said, hey, I just want you to know that I never took that article down because I don't believe in erasing your mistakes.
Yeah.
I think you should live with your past. But I told him that, you know, I really felt stupid about doing that, and I was really sorry. And he was amazingly gracious about it. And that's probably the last time I had any kind of communication with the guy. But he left me with a very positive impression because he could have really taken me to task. And some people did. From time to time over things that I said, or, you know, we got into it occasionally, but that guy was really cool about it. In the end, but of course, I was the winner and he was the loser. So he didn't have to be that way, you know?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit because I do remember towards the end that he had supposedly, you know, made contact with somebody, I think, you know, maybe it was like AMD or somebody making one of the, you know, the chipset for the GameCube, and we had a, you know, pretty good authoritative interview up, but it was only later he kind of we learned that the person we had made contact with wasn't who they claimed to be, so we basically were duped with a fake interview, and we published that, and, you know, we took it down and we realized that after the fact, or he realized it because, you know, that was all him. But I can guarantee you that any, you know, aggressiveness or any how he came off, that was with the best intentions behind it. I remember some point, and I don't know if it may have been you, but some people kind of describe Nintendo Nation as a shock site. And the way he kind of explained things and reported things, or quote unquote reported things, was a little, unorthodox. But he did get a lot right, too. And a lot of people did turn to him for, information like any of the other websites. I don't know if that would have continued for long had, the eFront thing not happened. I don't know how long he would have gone on if that sort of stuff continued. I know I had a lot more in me. I would have kept going for who knows how long if the site stayed up. But, it just didn't work out. So maybe it was for the best that it happened that way. Nobody likes to see a website go down in the way that it did. But, that's all water under the bridge at that point. So, can't go back and change anything.
Yeah. Well, when this all went down, do you recall how you ended up at Planet GameCube? Did you approach Billy, or I guess it might have even been Max at the time, to say, hey, I can't do this anymore. My site is gone. Can I work with you guys? Or did we come and recruit you? Do you remember how that went down?
Yeah, for the most part, it wasn't an immediate thing because Nintendo Nation was sort of isolated from everybody else for much of the reasons you describe. And Billy especially had a big old feud with Don. So I'm, I'm sort of like this free agent. Nobody's really clamoring, hey, we got to hire this guy. So what I had to do is at the time, so I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? So I was working my first job still, retail job. And so I thought, maybe I could make something out of this. So I actually kind of put the feelers out to make my own website, which I called Video Game Retail Report. Basically, it was an idea I had to where – working in Kmart, basically, people got questions about video games. A lot of them are really stupid questions about video games. So I thought, I'm sure other people that work retail around the country have really stupid, dumb stories about people buying video games. So maybe I could make a website about that. So I built something up. I posted a few things. But along the way, I started thinking, I'm going to need another Nintendo community to hang around at. So later that summer in 2001, I think it was like August or so, I registered for Planet GameCube forums, started hanging around the chat room a little bit, and just basically started the process over. I got to build up a little reputation in the community. Like, hey, yeah, I'm the guy to the mailbag every day, but I'm not the horrible person that Don was. Look at me, kind of thing. And, I started sending in news tips and, people got to know me. And I think what had to happen is that I think I asked Billy about it. And I actually do remember the kind of the tone of the conversation that we had. I did need to win him over initially. And the chat that we had, there was the AIM or the ICQ message session or whatever we had that he basically said, well, okay, I'm going to hire you, but don't fuck up. it was along those lines. So that was the next year. And then as, I think the first thing I wrote for the site was a review of Extreme G3. And that was March 2002.
So what do you remember about being involved in Planet Trivia? And then you kind of co-founded Radio Trivia, didn't you?
Not Radio Trivia. I thought that was you that actually co-founded that.
Well, sort of, but you were involved in it very early.
Yeah, it was the podcast that TOAP and I devised.
Okay, so you're co-founder of the podcast edition.
Right. Okay. Right. But let's back up to trivia, regular trivia.
Yeah.
Planet Trivia. And that was sort of one of the reasons why I ultimately settled back on Planet GameCube after, Nintendo Nation shut down is that, okay, so, we got the forum, but, the chat room was also pretty active as most chat rooms were back at this time on the internet. And you had the weekly trivia contests. Ty Sugar was running them at the time, I believe. And, once a week or whenever he did it, you'd ask a Nintendo question in the chat room. and everybody in the chat room try to furiously type out the answer as fast as possible and or cheat on Google or whatever the search engine was at the time as fast as possible. Google wasn't around then back then yet, was it?
No, it would have been probably Yahoo or...
Alta Vista, baby.
Sure.
But, yeah, so that's Planet Trivia, and that's been... I guess technically it is still going on to this day in the form of radio trivia, but... after I got hired onto the site, I think I picked up – I don't know how exactly it fell into my lap, but I was still doing the trivia or competing in the trivia. And at some point I said, okay, well, I'll take over trivia. I will become the trivia guru, which was my actual title on the site. And then I started writing all the questions – as many of the questions as I could. Every week I was trying to beg people to write me questions, because it's hard writing questions. The easy stuff goes away and you got to dig a little deeper.
Yeah. Well, and you always are dependent on your own experiences of playing games to write those trivia questions. And so at some point people kind of know the games that you like. And so,
well,
that
sure,
makes
but
it easier, and you kind of start repeating, and you're asking multiple questions about the same games. So it's always good to bring in fresh perspectives and get people to contribute things that that you wouldn't have ever been able to come up with.
Well, sure. I also used GameFAQs. That was a good resource. It's like I haven't done that game. I looked through the facts to see if there's any question I can glean out of this, you know. So that went on for the first couple of early years. A year after I got hired, I became news editor, but I was still doing trivia for a year and a half, I think even 2 years after that. And eventually the whole news editor thing just was starting to really tax the resources I had available myself. So I had to start to kind of wean off of that. And what I was able to remember/find out by looking back on the website is that once radio trivia kind of started off, because like in the chat room there was also the radio server, so yeah, there was the game music, and that was starting to kind of maybe become a part of trivia. We kind of integrate musical, music or even musical questions in there, I think, from time to time. So what happened was that became radio trivia, where they'd play the video game music over the radio and the people in the chat room would try to figure out the name of the game being played over the radio based on the game music. So that started off by being the thing that happened after Planet Trivia. And then that started alternating with Planet Trivia. And then Planet Trivia basically stopped altogether at some point, probably 2004, 2005, maybe.
That seems about right. Yeah, I'd have to verify. Yeah. The final one. It just kind of fizzled out, I think, because people weren't participating as much in the chat room.
Yeah, it was the same like 7 or 8 people.
Right. And it's so much work to put together that at some point it seems like not the best use of our time.
Exactly. So, but still, at the time we were doing the trivia, we were giving away some pretty serious prizes to the winners. I remember that at one point, and I still can't believe this, we gave away a package that included a GameCube, 2 Wavebirds, and Metroid Prime 2.
Jeez.
I know. And anybody could win it. They just needed to be in the chat room and participate in our little trivia game, and they could get, what would that be at the time, like $450, $500 worth of stuff?
It's pretty wild. Yeah,
I know. So once Planet Trivia stopped, radio trivia was sort of the main event, and then even that started getting a little hard to put together. TYP was the one, I think, that was in charge of that one. So let's see, when was the first podcast? I'm sure that happened after I was director.
No, it would have been summer, so June of 2006 would have been the first, what would become Radio Free Nintendo.
Well, that's RFN, but I'm talking about Radio Trivia.
Oh, Radio Trivia. I think it probably would have started around 08.
Yeah, let me see. Like the podcast Radio Trivia. Oh,
2007 or 2008, I think.
Yeah, we did the pilot on February 23, 2007. So, okay. Yeah, so the story behind that is we still wanted to keep the old trivia thing alive because that was sort of our, you know, a legacy thing of the website. But obviously we didn't have any time to do it live anymore. So the podcast thing was sort of perfect, especially because RFN had started, you know, a few months before that. So we were beginning to get our feet wet with this whole podcasting thing. So TYP and I got our heads together. We kind of thought we want to keep doing video game music, and we think this podcast thing would be great. And, well, what if we kind of make it a whole trivia thing where people still have to guess the game based off of the music? So we kind of devised the format pretty quickly. But the thing that I added, and this is actually one of my most favorite things I've ever done for the website, is the whole concept of the hint question.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a nice little double-edged thing, is that if you know the song, if you know the music, that hint question's like an extra little challenge for you. If you don't know the song or the music, that hint question is a hint that might kind of get you that little extra over there. Like, oh, that's what that game's from. Oh, that's the music. And then you get the game. So it was the perfect thing for everybody enjoying the podcast. And, you know, Radio Trivia was a bit slower lately, as you can understand. But, you know, it's still going strong. And I've been on a couple of the newer ones lately, so that's fun.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Radio Trivia. So I have to thank you for helping to kick that off and you know, also helping and encouraging Michael to keep doing it. I mean, I've talked with him extensively about it in another one of these interviews, but it is a special show. And I remember really pushing a lot for him to do a podcast version of it because the audience was dwindling, as you said, and it is a incredibly complicated and difficult thing to set up and perform. And I felt that having a way to record it and keep it for posterity was important. And thankfully now, it's been close to 10 years later. And we have, not only is it still alive, but we have this incredible archive of Radio Trivia episodes that will be fun and interesting forever to listen to. So I'm so excited that we have that now because, yeah, I mean, the live versions were special and different in their own way, but they were ephemeral, and that could have very easily been lost to time.
Well, you still get the live version too, you know, sort of with the telethon, so mm-hmm. it's still kind of kicking around. So right. it's really everything. It works live and it works as a podcast.
Right. Absolutely. So let's talk about you becoming director. Because you're going to have a lot to say about that period of time, I'm sure. So this happened in late 2006. I'm actually looking at your article where you're announcing the future of Planet GameCube. That's from November 2nd, 2006. And I could say my version of it because you were my successor. So I was running the website and had been for about 3.5 years at that point. And I had just moved to Colorado from Alabama. And basically, my entire life had been turned upside down. You know, I mean, I'd never lived anywhere but Alabama for 24 years, and suddenly I'm on the other side of the country in a completely new place, new people, new everything, studying a completely different topic even than what I had been doing before, and was trying to make a really firm commitment to my studies. You know, I was in this PhD program, and I kind of felt it may not be responsible for me to try to run this very large, complicated organization and spend the amount of time that I did on it while also trying to successfully obtain a PhD in a difficult subject area. So I talked about it with Billy, who is our founder, of course, and I talked about it with a few other people. And you know, Billy was like, well, you know, if you're going to do this, I want you to know who's going to take over. I want you to think about it. I want you to pick somebody and talk to them and convince them to do it. and make sure that they're able to. And so I thought about it for a while, and I don't remember who all I considered, to tell you the truth. I remember where I was when the idea really kind of gelled in my mind. I was walking around campus at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I picked up the phone, my cell phone, and I called Billy, and I said, "This might be a surprise to you, but I think the best person would be Windy Man." And he was a little surprised. He said, okay, I think I get it. I see it. And, you know, I think maybe surprised because you weren't, like, second in command at the time, right?
So yeah.
You and I had worked together a lot. I mean, you were the news editor and you were doing the mailbag and stuff like that. You had been involved in the trivia stuff. I mean, you'd been involved for years by that point, about 5 years, doing various different things. And we had worked together a lot, and I'd always had so much respect for you and had really enjoyed working with you. And, of course, I'd gotten to meet you a few times at that point. We got to hang out at E3 and do stuff together. So, I mean, I felt like I knew you pretty well, and I had a pretty good idea that you could do it. And the number one thing that I kept coming back to was that I thought you were dedicated. I thought that, I mean, your output was pretty crazy back in 2006. The amount that you were involved in the site, probably no one else could compare, or certainly no one could exceed you. And so I thought, you know, with the new system coming out that year, there's going to be a lot of new people coming to the site. There's going to be a lot of action. There's going to be a lot of games to cover. There's a ton of work to do, much more than there had been. I had the easy part in the waning years of the GameCube. There's relatively little material to cover. Our audience suffered for it, for sure. But, you know, I mean, it was manageable. With the Wii, I felt like I needed somebody who could be organized, who understood everything that needed to be done, and would really stick with it and carry it through. And, you know, I thought you did a pretty good job, especially through the early days of the Wii, which was a pretty insane time in a way that none of us really, including Nintendo, no one really understood what it would be like before it actually happened. So can you tell me what is your memory of this time, and how did you take this request, and what was your plan going into taking over this big job as director of the website?
Well, sure. I think it started, I would say, for me, kind of leading up to this, late 2005, early 2006. Obviously, at this time, I had no idea that, you know, hey, we're going to make you in charge of everything that would ever be a possibility. But the thing I do remember is that while I was, you know, started as a staff writer, then I was news editor/trivia guy, then just straight do all the news editing, I was just, you know, just a regular member of staff. And then at some point along the way, I got promoted up to senior staff. And at the time it happened, everybody was like, why didn't we do this sooner? I mean, I didn't think to ask. I didn't know to ask. I didn't care to ask. I was just happy plugging away at the news, making sure things were updated, doing my reviews, doing my previews, just doing what I needed to do. You're like, my list of stuff, let's get it done. Did it. Great. I'm going to go play some video games. If I need it, I'll get back to work. So once I got up to senior staff, then I started realizing, you know, actually I've been here a while. I'm doing an okay job at this moment. So then I get into the secret meetings and all that.
Oh, the Jedi meetings?
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have been on the PGC Jedi. That's right. Yep.
So, you know, so I get upgraded as, you know, of senior staff. I'm like, okay, well, I'm still doing my work. Now I know a little bit what's going on behind the scenes. That affects me a little bit. But for the most part, I'm just digging in and doing my thing. So then, you know, going into 2006, that's about, you know, we start to understand and realize that, hey, the, you know, new system, the Nintendo Wii, whenever Nintendo announced the name of it, and we're playing at GameCube, and ooh, that's not going to work anymore, is it?
Right.
So I'm sure I remember you mentioning that kind of started with you, what, about at least a year, more than a year, before we actually switched over, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. We were thinking about changing the name of the site for a long time, and it was just very, very difficult to come up with the right name. And once we did, it was a lot of work to rebrand our website. You know, I mean, we had to completely redesign it and change the logos and the banners and the text on everything. It was a huge project.
Yeah, and I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it sort of slowly and then quickly dawned on me that, you know, I'm doing the news. I'm, you know, a senior physician on the website. There's going to be a lot more work to do very quickly. So I already had this mentality in mind when you called me about this. And you straight up asked me, like, do you want to be the director of the website? Do you want to kind of lead us into the new era of the website? And I was like, oh, okay. I didn't really know how to take it at the time other than just another task for me to do, like any other task for me to do. But I brightly said, you know what, let me think about this a little bit, because I kind of first needed to understand the gravity of the job you were asking me to do before I could say yes or no to it. Because at the time I just kind of rolled with the question, but I kind of had to stop myself and say, okay, stop, think about this. So I thought about it, and I knew that there were going to be some pros and cons to doing it, and I knew that there would be some challenges to doing it. But at the end of the day, I was just thinking, you know what? I've done all this stuff already. Whatever the worst that could happen would not be the end of the world, no matter what. So I said, you know what? I'm going to try it. I got to do it. Let's go for it. And then that sort of started the whole process of getting swept into the redesign and having to do all the stuff that entails the director. Not as much stuff as you did, because you sort of broke it up into different departments. You did the PR, and you did the shipping parts, and then I was the director. So I think that's how you broke it down.
Yeah, so let me explain it quickly. So when I was director, I had consolidated certain things that I thought were very important to the website, especially involving how we related to publishers, including Nintendo and all the other companies that make games. And I wanted there to be a central person for all those companies to talk to, so that when somebody called them and said, hey, I represent this website, I have a question or a request or something to send to you, I wanted them to know that it was really us. Because yeah, I had heard a lot of stories, and this is a real serious concern among PR people. I'd heard actually people impersonating us, saying that they were affiliated with our website and asking these companies to send them games. And then the PR person would say, oh, well, I already sent a copy for review to this other person. I'd say, I don't know who that is. That person is lying to you. I have no idea. Huh. So anyway, there's a lot of reasons that I wanted that to all be kind of consolidated. And so I was concerned about handing all of that over, because I knew that I could do it well, but that's my particular skill set, right?
Right.
And so I didn't necessarily feel comfortable telling someone, I want you to do my job, and I want you to do it in exactly the same way I did it. So my idea was to break up some of these responsibilities, and my hope was that that would make it a little bit more palatable to you and a little bit easier for you to grasp and get used to. And then you can always rearrange things later as you see fit. So, yeah, I did. I assigned that over to my friend Evan Birchfield, who ended up not doing it for very long. I think maybe a year at the most. I don't know, because I wasn't as involved once you took over. So there were certain things about how the site was being run that I wasn't quite as privy to or that I'm just not as involved in. But yeah, I think Evan did it for a while. And then the shipping, that ended up – eventually we got Mike Gannon to do that, Pale Zero, out of the northeast of the U.S. And so that was a huge load off of my shoulders, because at the time I still had – boxes and boxes worth of old E3 DVDs that we were still selling, and I had Planet GameCube t-shirts and stuff. And I mean, this stuff, I was carrying it across the country with me, trying to, you know, mail this stuff out all the time. So anyway, to finally get rid of all that and kind of offload that logistics burden off of me on top of everything else was a huge deal personally. But I was glad that I didn't have to burden you with it as well, especially.
Well, I'm thankful for that because I had enough to deal with, especially with the Wii launch and, oh, geez, everything, like the complete year after the Wii launch. Oh, my God.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, what was it like for you running the site during the launch of the most successful gaming console of all time?
I don't even remember half of it, man. Geez, there was always something for me to do, and there was always something for everybody else to do. Oh, man. I mean, it was crazy. It was pure crazy. And I think, really, if you want me to kind of sum it all up, basically that entire month after launch, you know, like leading up to launch and the whole launch, like after launch, that was sort of – like there was that before that and then after that. That was sort of like, okay, you'll remember this moment for the rest of your life kind of thing. Because during that time period, we had the Twilight Princess event in Seattle. That's when I went up for that. We kind of couple of days where they just locked us in a room and we got to play Twilight Princess for a couple of days. Then
was
there
that, was that you visiting Nintendo?
Yes, it was.
Was that your first time?
Yes, it was.
Was it magical?
It was life changing.
It was for me.
I mean, we can talk about that a little bit later, but not only the Twilight Princess event, then there was the Wii launch itself. TYP and I went down to City Walk, and we did a RFN special. It's a RFN 27, where I just basically had my voice recorder, and I went around interviewing people, talking to people, went up and down the line, general impressions. And here I am sitting in this trailer, kind of behind a building, talking to Nintendo's vice president of marketing, George Harrison.
Yep.
And at that moment, I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? It just sort of, at that moment, it just kind of all hit me. It was like, okay, a couple of years ago, I was just answering people's questions. Mm-hmm. And now I'm talking to, like, the top two or three executive at Nintendo. Like, mind-blown kind of thing. And
I remember that podcast episode very well, by the way.
That was one of my favorite things I've ever done for the site,
too. I was really impressed with just the – I mean, the sense of place. It was not any kind of normal podcast by our standards. It was more like a radio piece. You were out on the street talking to people standing in line, interviewing executives. There was a lot of describing the scene. You know, I mean, it was really this kind of amazing slice of life moment, and what ended up being really kind of a historic moment in Nintendo's history. And you guys really kind of captured it in audio form in a way that I had never heard before. And I remember listening to this thinking, this is a pretty special podcast. I mean, this is a pretty special thing that you guys were able to do. And it really felt like reporting in a way that we didn't normally really get to do. You know, it wasn't – I went and played this thing, and then I wrote up an article about it, and now you can read my article. It was – this is a document from the moment when it was happening. And we were there, and we're setting up the parts of it that you need to know, and the rest of it, we're going to actually let the people give it to you in their own words. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I kind of – most of that was actually kind of seat of my pants. Going in, I had a couple of ideas of what I wanted to do. I think I remember I did a blog or an editorial or somewhere along the lines. Like, I don't want to get out of line and, you know, have a nice – cushy media, easy access to get my system at launch. I wanted to stay in that line all night. Of course, it didn't work out that way, and I'm kind of glad it didn't work out that way. But a part of me was like, you know, I still kind of want to be in this line because I've never really had to be in a line for any like home system or any piece of technology. I'm always able to just go up and get it. And that's nice, but that little dork in me is kind of feels like it's missing out on something. that was a great day. And, you know, I think it was it the day before or the day of, we flipped the switch and now we're Nintendo World Report. And that all happened in a matter of days and weeks. And then all the games are coming out, reviews, and, you know, all the news we can, all the launch reports. Oh, shoot. That's right. I remember we did a special called Wii Launch Adventures. I basically called all the staff's experiences for trying to get a Wii, and we just put it together in a feature. And I remember reading through some of these, and I'm like, whoa, like, we know what we're doing and we're still going through this stuff. Just imagine what it's like for the average person. And there were a lot of average people getting this thing if they could find it.
By the way, did you end up getting your Wii at that launch event?
I did.
Okay, good. Because I know that this is a weird footnote to that whole thing, but I had the review system from Nintendo. So I never bought a Wii. I never have. Right. I did buy one for my mom a few years later, but I never bought one for myself. And, so I got the system and the component cables, which ended up being quite a collector's item. I wish I still had them. And then Zelda and Excite Truck and
Excite Truck
Esports, of course. So I had all that stuff a week before the system came out, and I had a never ending parade of friends from school coming over to play it. And of course, all they wanted to do was bowling. I wanted to show them Excite Truck and Zelda, and the only thing anybody wanted to do was play bowling. And that continued for months and months and months afterward, because people still couldn't get them even long afterward. But I'm trying to remember why I had the system when you were the director. I guess it was – I think I was serving officially as a reviews editor at
the
time.
Yeah, you were.
And that was something that I felt like I wanted to stay involved and do something important for the site, and I kind of wanted to focus on maybe a part of it that I enjoyed a lot, which was reviewing. And so I ended up getting probably too involved with game reviews for a couple years there while you were running the site. But I had to review that Zelda game. I had a week to review Twilight Princess and Wii Sports and Excite Truck and the system. And it was rough. It was difficult to do that.
Oh, you poor thing!
Hey, you know, reviewing games is a weird thing. It's not nearly as much fun as most people would think, but I like doing it. So anyway, I was sitting here wondering, wait, why did I have all this stuff when you're running the site? But yeah, I guess it makes sense if I was reviews editor.
Yeah, I think we all agreed upon it at some point. Yeah. I mean, I don't ever recall saying, hey, give me that Wii. Like, no, I'm going to get the Wii next week. You know, I got enough to worry about with the site. So You're good. You're cool.
Well, I know you had Smash Brothers long before I did.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember you throwing like a party at your house and a bunch of people came over. That was another – was that a podcast? I think that was a podcast too.
No, that wasn't a podcast. That was another one of the favorite things I ever wrote for the site. But a little story before that. Obviously, Super Smash Brothers Brawl, everybody's freaking out that, oh, holy crap, it's new Smash Brothers, as we all did, you know, with the Wii U version, or whoever could, you know, whoever had a Wii U anyway. But the thing is that, okay, so we're going to do import coverage. I think I had imported a Wii before that point. If not, I got the imported Wii with Smash Brothers. I think I got it with Smash Brothers. But our Japan correspondent still works for the site, James Charlton. He needed to go fetch the game for me at launch. And, you know, so we're always little pins and needles. Are we going to get a copy before it sells out? You know, are we going to not have it, the game, you know, first thing? So he messages me, you know, hey, I got the game. I got, you know, Daidon through Smash Brothers X. I was like, oh, sweet. We're going to have good coverage of the game. And then he tells me the story about how he acquired it. And apparently he was the last person in line to get the last copy on the shelf.
Oh, my God.
And here's the kicker. The person behind him, and this is according to him, if I recall this correctly, was basically a grandma, an old lady. So basically, we got the last copy of Smash Brothers from an old lady.
Yeah, but we got way more use out of it than she would have.
Oh, I'm sure she's not even around anymore.
Oh, wow.
I'm kidding. She's healthy and on a farm somewhere. But, yeah, we got the game, and I'm starting to play it and doing the impressions and, you know, what we do with import games. But, you know, I'm only playing it by myself. TYP came over. We played co-op Subspace Emissary. I think Bloodworth came by a couple of times, too. But it was only me and, you know, the small circle of friends that was able to really play it multiplayer. So I realized two things. One, we're really going to need a lot of people to properly play in this game so I can cover it properly. And the whole thing about me really wanting to interact with our readers. And this is obviously something that's kind of been with me since the very beginning, me writing about, you know, anything Nintendo. So I don't remember how the notion came to me, but when I posted it on the site, hey, you know, you live in the Southern California, Los Angeles area, and you want to play Smash Brothers, you know, a couple of weeks before it comes out, just come on down and we'll play Smash Brothers for, you know, 12, 14, however many hours we play it for.
And so you were inviting all these strangers from the internet to come to your house?
Sure. What's the worst that could happen?
It was a more innocent age, 2007, 2008, maybe early 2008.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really that concerned about it. I made it pretty clear, hey, you know, don't be an asshole, basically. I can kick you out. This is my house. Mm. You're here to play Smash Brothers. You're my guests. You know, alcohol, smoking, cool. Just be casual about it, and we'll have a good time. So I think we got about 20, give or take, all together throughout the day. And, I mean, it was perfect. And I recently went back and reread the article I wrote about it. And I'm just it just worked out perfectly how the night went. You know, new people getting to know the game. Let's try tournament mode. We're hungry. Let's talk. Let's order some pizza. Talk about the game a little bit. Watch other people play online because you couldn't ever play online yourself because the internet was crappy. And then another forums person brought over another Wii, and we had two Wiis going. I was able to get some video capture of the game. And then the last couple of people that left were also the first couple of people that showed up. I'm like, wow. Okay, dudes, if you guys are playing for 12 hours straight, I'm not done yet. So it was basically like the last four or three people, and by 2 a.m. we were done. And I just had this giant list of notes that you could only get when 10, 12, 15, 14, 16 people are huddled around the room watching people play.
So you were working the whole time.
Yeah, working. Yeah, sure.
But you were. I mean, you were observing and taking notes and thinking critically about what's happening.
Of course. I mean, that was why I brought people over to play. It wasn't just to have a good time. I mean, it was to have a good time, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had this import copy of the game. There were still the necessary previews and information to glean from the game. So, well, of course I'm going to, you know, do that. You have to do that. It's your job. It's your gerb. So, like I said, it worked out perfectly that it was, you know, the right amount of people came over, had a good mix of experienced people and, you know, relatively new people. In fact, my brother came over and he hadn't played Smash Brothers. You know, he played a little bit of Melee, but we were basically on the N64 playing each other back in the day. And one of the things I mentioned is, well, okay, so you basically completely missed Melee and you haven't played the game in, you know, 8 years or whatever. How well would you be able to pick it back up? And he jumped right back in like he never missed a thing. So, like, okay, that's, you know, important information for people. So I put that in the article.
Yeah. He didn't complain about tripping.
Well, so, I noticed it, but I didn't realize the ramifications of it.
Right, right.
Because it was annoying in the end, but
for most of us, there really aren't any ramifications for it. But
sure,
for some people, it's a game breaker.
Deal breaker.
I want to talk about the website redesign, because that's something that happened in stages. It started when I was director, and we got some of it done around then. And then you took over right before we did a cosmetic change, which was to become Nintendo World Report. But I want to say that the cosmetic change was somewhat separate from the underlying website structure being upgraded. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Fill me in on some of the details here, because I'm pretty fuzzy on it.
Yeah, what I was able to remember, and I actually have a couple of old chat logs that I found on my hard drive, too, that kind of helped me remember all the stuff.
Please.
Yeah, I'll send you what I have. It's not that many, but it was enough for me to remember this. So I think that the initial stage of the project was the back end. And so you had Brendan Gallagher did all the CSS, and Ryan Jones was kind of involved with the initial, the whole design, but he was also kind of there sort of in the background to make sure all the back end would kind of match up with the front end when it was all said and done.
So let's clarify real quick. Brendan Gallagher, some of our readers and listeners may know him as Gahiggity, which is a username that he was very well known for at NeoGAF and also on our own forums. Brendan was hired. I hired Brendan probably around 2005. Specifically as a coder. I think he was a Cold Fusion programmer primarily, and he was trying to code up our website. And then Ryan Jones was our staff artist. So he was generating something we call TSIs, which are top story images, which are the little kind of rectangular banners that we would put up a row or even two rows of at the top of the homepage. And that was kind of a quick way to change up the look of the site, and then also give people convenient clicks to things that otherwise might just scroll right off the page.
Top stories, basically.
Yes, our top stories. And those were our headlines, effectively. They're graphical headlines. And so Ryan designed those and kind of helped develop the system for how those worked. And then Ryan, his more longer-term job was basically designing a look for the new website. So we had been on the purple Planet. So the Planet GameCube was originally green. That was Justin Nation's first version that he and I talked about on a previous interview. And then eventually when the GameCube came out, we switched into a purple scheme. And that was – a lot of people will kind of remember that was kind of the heyday of Planet GameCube. That's kind of the – you know, the design that they might remember the most. It's the one I remember the most.
Yeah.
And then for Nintendo World Report, we were going into something that really we've never – we never changed too much in the 10 years since then, which is this kind of white background with kind of a soft blue and black kind of text and banner design. And that's something that Ryan Jones came up with, and he was, you know, choosing where the columns go and how thick are these banners and what links do we want to, you know, I mean, and I was working with him, and TYP was working with him, and then you were working with him. So how did you kind of come into that and take over that project, and what happened with all that?
Well, right, and even before that, it wasn't just the look of Planet GameCube. It was also sort of the blog listing format. Basically, anything that was new goes to the top, and the older it is, the further down it goes. And that was pretty much exactly how it had been since, you know, Planet N 2000. It was unchanged for, 7 years at that point. So we also had a bunch of problems with just, you know, keeping important stories new and like at the top besides the TSIs, and the games database was a little bit of a wreck. And I remember TYP and Aaron Kaluska, who were basically the IT guys, it was basically a mess. So it wasn't just the front end, it was also the back end. And that was sort of what was going on by the time I had come on. And when I was starting to talk with Ryan, it was, you know, once the whole aesthetic of the Wii was pretty much known, it became kind of clear to him and clear to me that, okay, we're going to kind of match the Wii look just as much as the Planet GameCube purple era matched the GameCube look, in so much as the colors and the feeling of the website. So I think also at this point we had the back end. I mostly kind of, we would understand how it would work. So when I was starting to talk with Ryan about kind of the idea I had for the site as far as what it would look like, we knew that we wanted more information in less space. We wanted to have better control over which stories we could highlight, not just the images, but maybe also like sticky a post. It's just like a regular news post at the top. It's not as important as a TSI, but still important enough that, hey, you got to know this is the thing that's happening. Mm. And especially too, and this was the thing that was important to me, was we wanted to better organize older stuff. It still might be on the front page, but it's a little bit further down, so we can still maybe get even more information down there without having like an infinite scroll or multiple pages of single blog post links. So when we kind of talking about this, we were weighing what's important, what do we need. I pretty much had an idea in my mind that okay, add space here and images here, top stories, and maybe we could have some additional links down at the bottom. So I ultimately sketched out kind of a rough front page look, and I gave this to Ryan. I said, "Well, can you mock something up that matches what this rough sketch out looks like?" So he mocked up something. I think I have that on my hard drive, as a matter of fact, still. And what he mocked up, I'd say 90% of that is exactly what the website still looks like today.
Wow.
Yeah. There have been some tweaks over the years, obviously. For the most part, we kind of nailed it. I mean, there's really no way of putting it. I mean, you've got like right now you have like in the top right corner on the desktop version. Anyway, you've got like the, follow us on Twitter and follow us on Facebook links.
Right. Those would not have been there in 2006.
Right.
Twitter didn't
exist
yet.
Yeah. So that I put that there because I knew like the top main ad wouldn't really fit perfectly on the page. Mm-hmm. So I call that area like the bonus box, like whatever we want to put up there. Like an advertisement or an update link or just whatever picture. And obviously that turned out to be like the social media area. I'm like, cool. Okay. So it's a flexible design. It works. And you added more top story images in the kind of like the main picture matrix. And I think there were some further changes down towards the bottom, but for the most part, it looks almost exactly like it did in that idea that came to my mind. Like what now, 9 years ago almost?
Yeah, I mean, as you're talking about it, I'm looking at this is, at our current website, and it's basically a white background, and there's this blue bar, this menu bar that has links to the different sections.
Yep.
And if you kind of like unfocus your eyes and just kind of look at the overall effect of it, that blue bar reminds me of the blue slot on the Wii, on a white Wii. When the system's on, you've got a disc in there, that slot glows blue, and it actually looks just like that. And I don't think I ever realized that before tonight.
So still full of surprise, isn't it?
It's almost subliminal, yeah, how well it works.
Well, that means it's well designed. You didn't even realize that until you don't even think about it, but you subconsciously know it. Yeah. And I remember specifically when the site launched, also because the Wii had the web browser. So I said, the site looks like a Wii, so fire it up on your web browser. It's the perfect complement to your Wii because it looks the same way or something to that effect. So, I'm looking at the front page too, and there it is. I'm not gonna say it's my baby because we all worked our asses off to get this thing together. Mm-hmm. But with a lot of things I do, I found the first idea I have is usually the thing. It's usually the one. And this is one of them. So I'm really proud about that one.
Well, and it's your legacy, And by the way, this the Future of Planet GameCube article that I mentioned earlier, this is from November 2nd. And obviously, the site was still called Planet GameCube. So you were the first director of Nintendo World Report. Now, that's a name that I chose based on a suggestion by Dan Bloodworth. But you really kind of owned it, Nintendo World Report was your website. How do you felt that went? I mean, you were director for roughly 2 years. what's your kind of overall feeling of how did you do as director, and what were your priorities, and what did you want the website to be, you know, and did you have anything specific in mind that you wanted to leave your stamp on it, and were you able to do that?
Well, sure. Coming in, a couple of things. First of all, you know, before I was director, I was news. So all of these years, I've had this, you know, pounding in my head, news, pretty. You know, we prided ourselves on being professional as much as we could be. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, with the news, like you said before that, really, since Planet GameCube really started becoming a destination, we really wanted to make sure that we got to the most original source on news as we could. So I was getting really good at doing that, you know, digging through links, checking out the Japanese websites and making sure, okay, that's the original source on like Famitsu or this, you know, magazine looks good. And we always, you know, link the source in the news story, which we still do, or you still do, or Nintendo World Report still does. So I had that, I guess you could call it the straight and level kind of view of doing things. And of course, I also was at the before the opportunity for being the director came up, I was working at THQ at kind of at the same time where I was doing the news at Nintendo World Report, testing video games over there. So I also had the kind of industry inside perspective as well, which actually served me pretty well because I could understand the other side of it. We as the enthusiast press of video game media, we're always wanting all the information that we can get for our audiences and for ourselves, because we want to know this stuff as soon as possible because we're stupid fanboys about some stuff a lot of the time. But I also could realize, well, you know, maybe it's not the best for the game, for the publishers to release this information early. I was working on a game where some information got leaked to Kotaku, and that was kind of crappy. So I kind of understood the other side of it too. So when I was talking with PR people, I really understood that, okay, there's a line you don't cross, or you try crossing it, but you'd be cute about it and try to get some information. So I kind of understood what they were going for or what they were working, which kind of helped me out in the earlier too. And of course, you know, doing the mailbag early Nintendo Nation. I was doing the mailbag now at this point for Nintendo World Report. Really, really, really believed in interacting with your readers, making sure that they knew that they were important, and not just saying that, but by doing stuff for them. So still do the mailbag. We had the podcasts going at this point. I had wanted to do for a while a lot more, you know, cool stuff on the website, like feature writing. So I think one of the earlier features we did, and I remember this doing very well for the website, was like a Wii Tricks and Secrets or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we just basically went through all like the like Wii Sports or the Wii Hardware, said, hey, here's all the cool stuff you can do. Like today, that would be any video, a clickbait video on YouTube or something, like a Game Explain video or something.
Right.
But at the time, that was like, you know, well, of course people are going to be searching for, like, you know, secrets, and like, they got this new system, what do I do with it? Oh, there's this cool stuff. You can change the color of your bowling ball or get the secret strike, or look, you can make your Wii slot turn blue or something. I don't know. But it was just a simple idea. But I really wanted to encourage people on staff, if you have an idea, do something with it. You know, get it on the site. If it's a cool idea, we can make something out of it, and, you know, people would appreciate that more. And later on, and I pushed this for a while, and I know you kind of push back on it. Like, we were a Nintendo site, but I also appreciated how we were kind of an independent Nintendo site. Is that we report on Nintendo, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're loyal to or biased towards Nintendo, like, you know, like a console fanboy would be. And for a while I said, well, you know, maybe we can do a, like a little side report on other systems and how it might be relevant in Nintendo. And, you know, I think you specifically said, well, we're a Nintendo site. We shouldn't do that. But, you know, I kept pushing, and I think it eventually sort of evolved into the staff blog that we had up for a while.
Yes.
And I remember, like, one of the first things I posted on the blog is that Mario Kart should be more like the Wipeout Racing series, because it's stupid that you get the blue shell when you're in last place. Why don't you get a turbo boost instead to help you get back up front? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, you should get the blue shell when you're in second place.
Well, here's the secret for defeating the blue shell. You be so good that you're so far ahead that it doesn't matter if you get hit with the blue shell.
That's pretty much the only strategy. Yeah.
Or you can just use the music box. That works too, now that you have that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of covering other sites, I think, or other systems.
Systems, yeah.
I don't remember exactly what I told you at the time, but I'm sure that it would have come from, hey, how do you draw the line with what's, you know, what's newsworthy or what's valid for us to bring in, and how do we limit, you know, how do we set some kind of threshold such that that doesn't become the dominant topic on the site? And that's very difficult to set those limits. It's, you know, those are very highly arguable, and I think maybe it's a slippery slope argument, you know, I think it was probably – you'd have to have a really discreet kind of set-aside way of doing it. And I think the blog, you know, ended up being a really good outlet for it, and that was a fairly short-lived feature that took a – it really kind of came way too late. I think if we'd had it a lot earlier, it would have been more effective. But, you know, we did have editorials about other games on other systems, and we had the podcast where these things would come up and get talked about in a very casual way.
Well, sure. That's kind of what I was
kept off of the front page.
Well, yeah, that's what I was ultimately going for, is that, you know, ultimately we're Nintendo, Nintendo first, Nintendo on the front page, Nintendo everywhere. But on the side, you can kind of see the other side of what we are. We're gamers. We like old games. And I remember specifically we were discussing the blog because we wanted to absolutely differentiate blog posts from, like, news and reviews and previews and such. And I if I recall, the blog links were pink and everything else was blue.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so we really differentiated it and say, okay, this is still the website. We're still covering Nintendo. But this is an area of the site where we were actually speaking our minds, not necessarily the opinions and views of the website as itself. You know what I mean? And especially RFN, as that got bigger and bigger. I mean, RFN was always kind of like that. But, you know, you're playing new business in the games you're playing. You're going to talk about any games, not just Nintendo games, because, you know, every game.
Although you expect people will always complain when it's not a Nintendo game.
Of course. us poor and disenfranchised Nintendo fans.
Right. I listen to this show to hear about Nintendo, not Xbox. Yes. I heard that many, many times. So, Steven, you mentioned working at THQ. Can you – I'm surprised this didn't come up earlier, but can you talk about what period of time – you were with THQ, and did they know that you were working on this Nintendo site? I mean, were they cool with it? What kind of arrangement did you have to make, and how did you keep your objectivity, you know, so that you weren't biased towards THQ or against them?
Okay, so just the full story. After my first job, Kmart. I left that because I wanted to go to school and I didn't want to work in retail for the rest of my life. And now Kmart's bankrupt. So, ha ha ha. Shows you. I went to, you know, kicked around a little bit at school and there's, okay, well, game testing. I mean, I've heard so many things about it. I know what I'm going to get into when I apply for this job. And even told the interviewers, like, I know what I'm getting into. And so, you know, they hired me and my first game was The Incredibles for the Game Boy Advance, because at the time THQ had all the Pixar movie licenses, the Disney licenses, something like that. So I did a good job there, and I worked on a bunch of other games, stories for all of them. But back to the question you asked, I put it on my resume that I was working for Planet GameCube, and it was never really brought up, but it was kind of understood both, you know, because it's a professional environment and, oh yeah, the NDAs they made me sign, that I really couldn't talk about anything outside of, you know, the company. And obviously that means I'm not going to talk about it on a website that, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people are going to read. Mm-hmm. So there was definitely a wall there. And it's interesting now that I think back about it, especially now that you're asking me, is, you know, I was doing a lot of stuff for the website around this time. This was summer 2004 was when I started working there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is me starting to kind of ramp up my news responsibilities and starting to get, you know, up into senior staff. And here I am working all these overtime shifts, these 24-hour testing shifts. Ooh. Ooh, yeah. By the second lunch break, you're a little loopy.
And, especially playing like motocross, whatever, for 24 hours straight.
Actually, let's see. I did two shifts. One of them was for the Incredibles console game, the movie game.
And I think I reviewed that. Or maybe.
And then the other one was the wrestling game, the 2006 Raw versus SmackDown.
Okay.
Or SmackDown versus Raw. Yeah, it's not so much the playing the game. You're not really playing the game. You're testing the game. So it's a job, and mm-hmm. I happen to be actually pretty good at the job, because I kind of understood how games work. I had taken a programming class in college, and I also sort of played around with my old Texas Instruments TI-83, programmed some games in there too. So I had a basic understanding of programming games, and I had an understanding of if something didn't work, I can kind of trace back and understand why it didn't work. I remember with the demo for The Incredibles, the boss at the end of the level didn't spawn sometimes. And I kind of worked out, okay, well, here's the trigger point where the boss spawns. And, oh, there's a little bit of a dip in the level geometry where if you hit that as you're crossing over the spawn point, the thing won't spawn. So I was like, whoa, okay. They nailed it down pretty quickly. And I was like, oh, that's a good one. So they shipped the demo with the bug in it, but they fixed it in the main game.
Well, that's cool.
Because who cares about a demo? But, you know, I was doing a pretty good job over THQ. Eventually, I went from the temporary kind of tryout level to the actual fully fledged employee of THQ, which was pretty cool. And, in fact, there was plenty of opportunity for advancement within the company. During my time there, just, you know, testing games, I applied for specialty positions. There was one department that all they did was to check games to make sure they conformed with a publisher or the console manufacturer's standards of practices.
Oh, so it was a certification.
Right.
Job.
So, you know, make sure the game still works when the controller is unplugged and plugged back in. You know, nothing funny happens at boot up. You know, stuff like that, boring stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied for the Nintendo part for that. Because they had one for Nintendo, one for Sony, one for Microsoft. And then there was another department called the Game Design Team that was basically an in-house Planet GameCube. They played other games. They kind of wrote up reports reviewing them effectively so they could see how other games are designed and maybe incorporate that back into their own games.
That was their job?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, I interviewed well, and I thought I had a pretty good chance. Had I got that job, I would have for sure left the site.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, but I didn't.
Well,
so I went back
for us. Sucks for you, though. I'm sure you were heartbroken. I mean, that sounds perfect.
Well, not so much heartbroken. I mean, it would have been perfect, but like I was doing with, you know, PGC and NWR, it's just, okay, well, get back to work. There's other stuff to do. Just here's what's in front of me. Let me just, you know, do the best job I can do with what I got in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just another bump in the road as far as I was concerned. And so still testing games. What else did I do? I did Destroy All Humans, did Evil Dead game.
I remember when I saw you 1 year, and this was probably 2005 or 2006, you had to work at E3. So
yeah, that was like 2005.
There's maybe one day of the show you were allowed, you had taken vacation or you were allowed off, and you worked with our site. And then the rest of the show, you had to be at THQ's booth demoing some kind of motorcycle game.
Yeah, that was the last game I worked on, was MotoGP 06.
Okay.
For the 360. And actually, let me give you a really good story about 2005. That was the year. How it worked is that half the show we had to be at the booth working the game, and the other half of it we got off. So, whatever, how long the days were. So, 6 hours in the booth, 6 hours, have fun at E3.
Okay.
So that worked out. I mean, I was still, I'm pretty sure I wrote a couple of things for the site because I could. Not that I couldn't do much, being there only half the show.
Right.
But okay, so here's the crazy thing about what happened in 2005. So I'm at the THQ booth. I'm working the show. I'm working the game. People will play it. People have questions. I mean, I'm just a tester. I'm not the PR person, but I can answer basic questions. Most of the people in E3 aren't all PR, but they're just kind of help you with the game and answer questions, what they can talk about. There was a camera crew with EB Games. They wanted to get somebody on tape and, talk about the game, interspersed with footage, and, have it on the TVs in the store, like they do with GameStop now.
Sure.
And they couldn't find a PR person. So my test lead comes up to me, and one of the booth, people in charge of the booth came up to me. He's like, yeah, you know this game pretty well. You want to, be on the interview? EB Games can talk to you about the game. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. I'm just going to roll with it. So they powder my nose with makeup.
Really?
And so rolling the cameras. And at this point, I'm pretty versed in PR speak, having to deal with it with all the other people, PR people we've been talking to. So I just basically enter PR speak mode. I know that I have to talk about this mode and this mode and this mode and this mode. And I fucking nailed that interview. My test lead looked at me afterwards and he was just like nodding. He's like, yeah, that was pretty good. And I felt so dirty afterwards. Like, I can't believe I did that.
So are you saying that you kind of knew how to do it from working at the website?
Yeah. Because this wasn't my first E3. I mean, this was my fourth E3 at this point.
So you gave a talk that you had been given dozens of times yourself.
Yes.
On the other end.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And so, I mean, it was kind of okay because I knew exactly what it was for. It's too bad that I wish I could have seen that video, because it probably just rolled in like EB Game stores and the game came out and that was, thrown away or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, that was just a funny thing. And then after the interview, go back to talking about the game, my shift's over, and there I am writing up this impressions for some, Game Boy game or DS game at that point, just for the website. And actually, that year was pretty nice, too, because I had an exhibitor badge as well as the media badge.
Oh, yeah.
So that was the ticket. I can just waltz right in there. We didn't have to do our little spy thing. I can just go right in goddamn floor and spy for us.
Let's see. Yeah, 2005. Unfortunately, there wasn't that much to spy in that
year. Nope. Nintendo wasn't launching the system.
Yeah, I think that was the year that I did get to play. This is another story for another day, but I think that is the year I got to play all of Nintendo's demos, including Donkey Kong Jungle Beat, at the Nintendo corporate party the night
before the show. Yeah, I remember
you talking
about
that. Yeah, but it was a day in advance, and all those games had already been announced basically at that point. But that's back when their press conference was the day before the show. So they announced all of them, and then the party was that night, and you got to play the games, and then the show would start the next day, and that was the first time most people got to play them. It's not a big deal.
I remember when Nintendo did press conferences.
And parties.
Yeah, those were the days.
They were indeed. So, let's talk about the sort of the end of your tenure on the site. this is kind of an unusual situation in that, you know, I mentioned before I was the reviews editor, but I was not, you know, I wanted to stay out of the most of the nitty gritty goings on of managing the site, because I had done that and I want, you know, I intentionally tried to retire away from it. So I was trying to do my job and be a good soldier, and take care of my business and make sure that all my section was done properly. And I tried to advise you when you needed help or when you asked for something. But, you know, if you let me, I would probably be the kind of person who would be overly involved even after quitting, right? And and knowing that about myself, I try really hard to give you the space, let you do things your own way, let you be responsible for it, and make sure that you get to take credit for what you do. But I've, you know, and my memory of this is pretty bad, I have to say, but because I had a lot of other stuff going on just in my life at the time. But this would have been, I think, let's see, around late 2008, very early 2009, because John took over. His article is called A New Year, A New Direction. It's from January 19th, 2009.
Right.
And this is where he's announcing that he's the new director. But I don't recall exactly who else was involved. I'm going to have to do some research on that. But I know that I was one of the people who asked John to do this. I think it was me and maybe one other person. It might have been Billy.
Yeah, it was Billy.
But
had to be Billy.
But we contacted John and we kind of asked if he would be willing to do this. And you weren't really involved in that process. So
no.
I think we asked you to step down and let John take over for the good of the site.
Right.
What is that like on your end?
Well, the fact that you wanted to kind of be a little hands off sort of hurt the situation that I was finding myself in, because, you know, coming into 2008, that's kind of when the whole housing bubble burst. And I'm talking about my real life situation, not the situation with the site.
Right.
And that actually kind of hurt my family and me pretty badly, because our family business, we have a print shop. We do offset commercial printing, marketing materials and such. And the vast majority of our clientele at the time was the real estate market. Lots of real estate agents, you know, printing flyers and promotional materials, business cards, that sort of stuff. So obviously when the housing market goes down, the real estate market goes down, and our business kind of went down, and it kind of went down really fast. So what was happening kind of on the site as far as my involvement with it, you know, going into the second half of 2008, and even I kind of knew it a little bit, was I wasn't dedicating as much time to the site that I really needed to be doing. I had to, you know, make sure everything was fine with my folks, and really me too, because I was working with them as well. So it kind of happened slowly at first. What was happening at home was, you know, it's a little more time doing some side things. But, you know, I have time. I've had, you know, lots of time in my other job, especially my THQ job. You know, I think I can still get the stuff done I need to get. But, you know, as the months went on, and there was a little bit of pride on my side, because I've only ever known to do things the way I've done them. I didn't really understand that not just my lack of actions, but the fact that I wasn't communicating my full situation clearly to the senior staff might have not been the best thing for the site overall.
Yeah.
It eventually came to the point where you and Billy contacted me and said, you know, basically, you know, we want, you know, Lindemann to take over. We're going to, you know, they think it's best for everybody if we, you know, remove you from duty. And at that point, I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. I wasn't going to say no to that. I mean, it was kind of the writing was on the wall a little bit.
Yeah, but I don't think we gave you a choice. I mean, we didn't ask you. I think we told you.
Yeah.
But I do remember being very relieved that you seemed okay with it. and that you seemed actually maybe a little bit relieved about it as well, because obviously you had things going on. I mean, there was a reason. This wasn't because you didn't care anymore. It was because you really couldn't do the job anymore. You just physically couldn't keep up with it.
And I mean, at the time, just like everything else involved with the site, it was just, okay, this is a thing that happened. No time to be upset about it. No time to really reflect on it. The original plan was for me to stay on as just, you know, like, you know, a senior editor or a writer or something.
Yeah.
But at just about that time when I was relieved of duty, things got really bad for us. I don't want to get into too many details, but one of the things that we had to do is that basically we had no internet. We couldn't do internet for a couple of months. So I was basically off the grid for a while. That sucked, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do to get through your situation. And, you know, we got through it. We're fine now. I'm back on the internet. Yay, internet. And, but yeah, I mean, I really wish that the situation for me personally was more ideal, obviously. Looking back, I do wish I had handled things a little bit differently so it didn't have to come to what it came to. But like I said, when I originally thought about becoming director, I knew in the back of my head that even in the worst case scenario, the staff and the leadership of the website, you know, it'd be strong enough and you know, fleet-footed enough to deal with the situation. Not that I had anticipated this happening, and obviously you guys wouldn't have anticipated it happening, but the fact that it did happen, you know, it sucks for everybody, but the things that needed to happen to sort of correct it happened. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, I understood, you understood, we all kind of realized, okay, this needs to happen. So I wouldn't be upset about it because I knew it was happening. And I know you guys weren't totally upset about it because you guys understood what was happening. So, you know, just like anything else, it happened. The site goes on. I deal with my stuff. And, you know, we're all still here. So, yay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm certainly glad that things have improved for your family. It's a pretty rough reason to have to step away from, you know, something that you were incredibly involved with. Did you ever come back to the site later on? I mean, did you ever really get involved again after that point?
No, I still kind of want to a little bit, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, like I said, I've done a couple of radio trivias, the podcasts. Sure. And they also had the Smash Brothers tournament. They like TYP asked me, was like, oh yeah, doing that for sure. I almost won the thing too. Yeah. I almost won the thing.
Yeah.
Your team. But yeah, I mean, no, it was pretty much me. Everybody else lost in the finals. I went 2-1. I almost won that last game too. But yeah, I mean, I still think about it. I still, you know, I'm still around on the site, you know, see the news story. There's Nintendo World Report. You got to see what's going on there. And see you go on the forums, talk back every once in a while. You know, I never went away. It's just, at this moment in time, I've got other things I'm doing. That's all.
Yeah. Well, can you talk a little bit about what you've been doing since you left Nintendo World Report back in early 2009?
Yeah, so I think that was when I was kind of away from the internet for a while. So I think I kind of came out of it later in that year, 2010. I think during this time period as well, other things sort of got me through the day. Right now, what I'm doing is that I have a website that covers roller derby. Roller derby has always been one of my most favoritest things in the world. I don't know how much you know about roller derby, but it's been something that's been around the country since 1935. And very recently, 2001, has sort of revived, primarily by women, which is actually pretty cool. They've got international tournaments, and they're actually broadcasting their games on ESPN3 now, at least the championships. So it's getting pretty big pretty fast. And the website I'm at is at rollerderbynotes.com. I'm sort of a general news and pretty active on the social medias, and I do lots of analysis and commentary especially. And, you know, getting pretty notable out there in the roller derby world, whether they like it or not.
So can you trace, can you make any kind of connection between working at Planet GameCube and Nintendo World Report and now Roller Derby Notes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of my experience for like all those 9 or 10 years I did the Nintendo thing completely applies to my website now. I mean, if there's like a news story that comes out, there I am just digging through everything, trying to find the original source. There's a lot of speculation and rumors that go around in roller derby, just like they would with any, like, you know, fanboy central video game environment, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's actually kind of a interesting parallel with the kind of website that PGC and NWR is compared to another website in the roller derby space. Because as you know, and as everybody listening to this knows, the website is a community effort. Everybody on staff is, you know, they basically came from the community of the website for the most part. And there is another website that was very much like that in the roller derby space called Derby News Network. And what they did is they, in the early days of roller derby, and this was also kind of the early days of video and video streaming on the internet. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking 2006, 2007, 2008, that kind of era. There was a bunch of different guys who did roller derby stuff, and they kind of came together to make this one centralized hub for all things roller derby, basically. So, you know, news and previews and game recaps and video streaming. They got all the people doing live streams of roller derby broadcasts and kind of put them all into a centralized hub. Now, it's an interesting parallel for me, because that's a lot very similar to what we were doing with the Nintendo stuff. We were basically aggregating all this content. We were also kind of curating it, not just putting it up there. We were also giving it the checks and making sure everything was accurate and up in a timely manner and that sort of stuff. But there came a point in the history of Derby News Network where the kind of the main player in roller derby, which is the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, the WFTDA, they were beginning, WFTDA was beginning to kind of protect their own self-interests, because what Derby News Network was starting to do was, basically money was starting to become involved in all this. Mm-hmm. And this isn't so much as speculation as what actually happened. That the Derby News Network was preparing to broadcast the playoff tournament. I think this was 2011, I think it was. And they had verbal agreements with sponsors and venues and, you know, the tournaments and all that. And the WFTDA kind of swooped in under the radar and said, no, we're going to produce everything. We have written contracts. Thanks, guys, but we'll take it from here.
This is a TV station, like a local broadcast station?
Not TV station. This is internet streaming. Okay. So it's a website, yeah. So the Derby News Network people were kind of scrambling. It's like, we had these agreements. We were going to handle everything this year. And it came out later that people not necessarily directly affiliated with the WFTDA basically violated non-disclosure agreements to sort of undercut Derby News Network. Okay. And basically shut them out of the process entirely. Long story short, Derby News Network is now no longer in existence, and a lot of people are not happy about it. And the reason why I bring up this story is because when we were kind of doing our thing, we were starting to get scoops. We broke the GameCube logo, the Nintendo DS logo, when I kind of walked into an office and took a picture of the through the window.
Oh,
at
yes.
E3 that one year.
I remember it well. I always check that room every time we go back to E3. No, there haven't been as good of a discovery ever since then.
Yeah. But we were at a point where, you know, we were doing quote unquote damage to Nintendo, because obviously they don't want that stuff leaked until they're ready to do it themselves. So at that point, when a website goes beyond aggregating, goes beyond curating, gets to the generating, we were a generator, original source of news and content or what have you. Exactly. We were actually the source of stuff. What Nintendo did with us is it started, okay, guys, good. How about you don't post all that stuff, but we'll start inviting you to our press conferences and our press events. We want to work with you so that you stop doing this stuff. Stop leaking our stuff.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a mutually beneficial relationship, one that still exists to this day with Nintendo World Report and Nintendo.
Yeah, I mean, it's more complicated than the way you describe it, but
it is, but that's the gist of it.
It's a fair summary, yes.
Right. But what happened on the roller derby side is that the Derby News Network website also got to that point where they were a primary source of roller derby broadcasts, basically. And the originator, or the main people, instead of saying, you're getting a big audience, let's work with you, let's make this mutually beneficial, many people associated with that organization basically completely cut them out of the process altogether. And roller derby lost a very, very, very valuable resource. And the situation around that was so bad, the website went through a big Kickstarter. They got like $20,000 or something for a website overhaul and relaunch and redesign, much like the redesign that we went through before the Wii launch.
Mm-hmm.
They had all this money. They had all the people working on it. They launched the site, and a couple of weeks later, they shut it down, because they were feeling they were not getting the respect that they feel that they deserved from the organization that effectively, I feel, put them out of business.
Wow.
So I see that, and I compare that to what we did. And that's sort of the thing that drives me and my website. It's kind of everything in my experience. I really believe in the interaction with the people. I'm making good contacts, good people in the sport. It's really important that we're kind of like a watchdog, as it were. Like, I'm a big fan of the organization, but I also keep a kind of a watchful eye on them, that maybe if you're doing something that goes against the best interests of everybody else, I'm going to call them out on that, that sort of thing. So it's really what I was doing with Planet GameCube and Nintendo World Report. But it's also nice that I can kind of do things at my own pace instead of having to do this, 2 hours, 3 hours every day.
Yeah.
Which is a really nice thing to have happen right now. And it's nice, too, that if I want to, like, turn this into something where I actually make a career out of it, I know I can do that because all the experience I have directing the site and even working before it, I'm applying it. I'm using it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's served me very well in life.
Yeah, that's good news. Good to hear. So we've gone longer than planned, Steven, so I feel like we should start to move towards the end of this interview. So I'll ask you the same question I ask everybody. Is there anything that you wanted to ask me about, anything that you ever wondered about the website from when I was director or otherwise?
Well, I mean, I always did wonder what you guys thought of me, and you did cover that pretty well. I mean, I'd like to think I'm a humble guy, or at least I try to be a humble guy. And you're like saying all these nice things about me, and like I thought, I never really thought about that. I know I had some disagreements with some people on staff for some stuff. I mean, I don't think I was ever as a hardliner as Billy was. Billy, geez, he was so infectious, but he was also. He'd be an ass if he didn't do stuff. He'd get on your ass. Mm. I never tried to be that kind of director, but then again, I didn't know how to be a director, so I didn't know how that works. But I guess what I would ask you, I mean, looking back on your experience with the site, I mean, you're still kind of there too, man, aren't you?
I mean, I'm retired other than the book, and okay. and everything that goes with the book, including stuff like this.
Well, I mean, at what point did you think that it was necessary for you to do the book? Like, I remember you hearing you off and on that, oh, I should do a book about this. But when did it start becoming a project that, okay, well, I do have a book here. Let's get started. When did that kind of come?
That was really, I mean, I've had been thinking about doing the book probably going back to like 2009 or 2010. So it's a long time ago. And I had that idea from some experience I'd had, you know, doing other writing. I'd written a short book, a few years earlier, and that had kind of gotten the bug in me. And especially as I got involved with the podcast and really stopped writing, I mean, I retired from writing game reviews, and I think it was 2009 was when that Chrono Trigger DS game came out. And I had just written hundreds of them, and I was exhausted, and I just, sorry, that's my alarm. I just couldn't do it anymore. After that point, my writing output went way down. And
oh, yeah.
That was the time, of course, that I took over the podcast and started hosting that. And that started to take up more and more of my time. And I really enjoyed it, and I wanted to focus on that and get better at it and try new things. And kind of that ended up becoming a project unto itself that in some ways – really mirrored the kind of rise and fall that I had as director of the website, including the part where it took me a very long time to walk away from it because I enjoyed it too much and I was afraid of what my life would be like if I didn't have it anymore. But yeah, I think it was the time when I stopped writing on a regular basis for the site that I started to think I should just do a book because that would give me a way to keep writing, but in a different way that would be more on my own schedule. And also, you know, looking back, I always felt that I was the obvious person to do the book because I had been involved with it almost as long as anybody.
Sure.
And through all these different eras, and I knew all the people, especially because I had been director and early on, I had the connection to the early people, including Billy and Justin and all those guys back from the very early days. But then I also had stayed involved even into kind of the later era of the Wii and even the Wii U with you and John and Neil and into the podcast era and all that other stuff. And now we're in the YouTube era of the website. And so,
yeah.
And so I've continued to stay, if not as involved anymore, at least in touch with all those people. And I still, you know, contribute occasionally just for fun. I get asked to come do something, and I'm happy to come do it. And so, you know, knowing that that was going to be the case, I kind of felt like, well, if anybody's ever going to do this, I would be the one to do it. And I'm a book guy, so I like books. You know, I like reading books. I like having books. I like writing them. And so, I felt that was kind of, you know, the internet is such a you know, even this beautiful archive of content that we have that spans 17 years of our website, it's all online and it's all sitting on a computer somewhere in a room that could be destroyed. And pieces of it, in fact, probably almost all of it, is distributed on other people's computers all over the planet. And so I don't, you know, I think the only thing that could destroy our legacy completely is if the Earth just blows up one day, and then the website is not really going to be my prime concern. But there, I do have a feeling that as much of a history and of a depth that we have in this massive archive of content that we've developed over the years, there's so much that's happened outside of that archive. And also, there's stuff even within the archive that no one will ever find. I mean, it's tens of thousands of web pages. So there's so much data to churn through, and you would have to have the kind of insider knowledge that I have to even really find a story through all of that, right? And so I just kind of feel like I'm the person to do it, and I feel like it's something that should be done. And I kind of have – finally, I have kind of created enough space in my life that's something that I can actually work on. So yeah, that's the long answer. And by the way, the answer to your first question of, you know, of what I thought of you or what we thought of you, is I guess the, the best way to summarize it is that probably the number one reason that I asked you to be my successor and to take over the director position and run the website is because I thought you were probably the person on the staff who was most like me, who best understood what I wanted from the website and what I felt that it contributed and how to achieve that, and that you had the energy to do it. So
yeah, and
you had been around a long time, so I felt that you had the history with the site. I mean, at that point, you had been on staff for 5 years, and that was longer than most people, right? So you had kind of been around, but you were a workhorse. You'd never tried to take over anything. You had never, you know, you weren't asking to do it, and I kind of felt that that was maybe one reason that you might be the right person to do it, because you weren't looking for it. You know, but I thought if we asked you to do it, you would take it seriously and you would do it. And I think you did.
Yeah. And I think looking back, even though I was, you know, only around for those 2 years and really maybe even effective for, you know, around a year and a half before things got real on my end, I'm really glad that I was there at for running the site at that time.
It was such a critical period.
Right. And, you know, like, especially, you know, after you asked me to do this interview for your book, I really started thinking about it. And there was a lot of stuff to power through. I mean, we didn't even talk about the E3 2007. It's just me running around Santa Monica.
Jeez. it maybe just as an encore to this interview, would you be willing to spend a few minutes just kind of going through that experience? Because that's something that's the only E3 between 2000 and 2015. That's the only E3 that I did not get to attend. And it destroyed me to not be there. But then after hearing the stories from you, I didn't feel quite so bad about it. So can you just take us out on an amusing anecdote of E3 2007 and the famous Santa Monica E3?
I'm actually regretting bringing this up. All right, yeah. So let's go out on that. So so we flipped the switch for Nintendo World Report, you know, late 2006 after the Wii launches. And then, you know, we're starting to get ready to prep for E3. I mean, the whole E3 itself, the fact that it changed so much, like in 2006, you know, it was supposed to be for media, but everybody knew that anybody can get into E3 anytime. And, you know, publishers were spending so much money, you know, fancying up their booths, trying to attract people to come to their booths. Apparently, you know, the powers that be thought that wasn't a good direction for the industry to go in.
Yeah, I think E3 2006 had about 80,000 attendees.
It was ridiculous.
It was the largest ever at that point, and I believe still is the largest E3 that ever happened.
Yeah, and actually, I wasn't there for but a couple of hours that year because I was working at THQ and I didn't get to go to the show that year. So I missed out. Oh, well. But what happened was that they decided to completely blow up the show. And they rechristened it the E3 Media and Business Summit or something like that.
That sounds right.
Yeah, so what they did was that instead of spending all this money for giant booths, we're just going to invite select media partners and business luminaries or whatever their jibber-jabber was in the press release. And we're going to hold this in Santa Monica. We're going to have sort of like a mini show floor in the hangar at the Santa Monica airport. And we're going to have all the meeting rooms dotted around various hotels in Santa Monica. And, you know, we were kind of all shocked when they made this change because we liked E3. I mean, yeah, it was busy, but we liked E3. I mean, it was E3. So we're like, no big deal. You know, we can handle this. But funny thing, when you change the name of your website, the E3 people aren't very smart when it comes to realizing that you are actually this well-respected website, and you are this well-respected website with, you know, big audience. Nintendo World Report? Never heard of you. We'll let you have one person go to the show. I drew the short straw, and...
you had the honor as director of representing our entire website. I mean, just to give people a sense of it, I mean, at E3 2006, I'm sure we had close to 25 people covering that show.
Oh yeah, we always had at least a dozen, almost 20.
Yeah, so we went from that down to one.
Right. So what happened was that, you know, even up until the end, we were fighting it. Like, come on, we need more than one person to do this. Didn't happen. So, I mean, I had a schedule. We were making all these appointments. I was trying to, you know, have plenty of time between each one. And looking back at the site, going through all the games I covered, I did like freaking 30 games all by myself, at least. All three of those days. Oh man, it didn't go very smoothly. I'm amazed that I got through that weekend. Granted, the way that they changed the show, it was possible for one person to do all of that. But it was pretty hairy. I mean, I think I missed one appointment for like Warner Brothers or some movie game studio, because when I was driving from one hotel to another, I ran into the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Yes, I remember hearing about this.
So, like, I'm just, you know, I'm driving down, you know, the direct route, and Farmers Market is like, oh, okay. Well, try to get around it. I found the hotel. You know, I got there in kind of a decent time. Then I couldn't find the room, and by this point it was like 20 minutes after, and I called the PR person. I was like, I'm sorry, I can't make it. Farmer's Market. And she was – she kind of like, oh, I understand. As if she, you know, had some sort of incident like this before with some other outlet. Like, it's like it's kind of everybody understood what the situation was. But geez, that was a crazy year too, just because they had a – they had like that was Metroid Prime 3 and Mario Galaxy. What else was there? Yeah, that was – I mean, Nintendo is pretty easy because, you know, they just herd everybody in. Here are our games. Here's our presentation. I think Miyamoto was there. And, you know, that was all easy because it's, you know, one company. Here are like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 games. But everybody else, one game over in this hotel, one game over in this hotel. Oh, we don't have a hotel. You have to go up to Santa, like the airport, check out our – little mini booth over there. Oh man, that was that was rough. That was really rough. But you know, here's the old workhorse falling on a sword to get it done.
Well, it was a Herculean effort, and I mean, certainly I was at home just like everybody else reading your coverage, and you know, it was an incredibly important time. I don't know if it was the most important E3 because they kind of purposefully diminished it. But you think about, you know, May or June of 2007. I mean, that was the first E3 after we launched. And how many companies were there trying to show their new Wii games? It must have been an incredible demand for your time. And there must have been a ton of stuff there to go look at. And they didn't make it easy for you.
No, there was a ton of stuff, yeah.
But you pulled it off, and thankfully, the powers that be behind E3, they kind of came together and said, we should do something a little bit more convenient for the people attending. And the next year, they actually took a very similar construct for what they did for E3 2007, but instead of having it spread out in all these hotels in Santa Monica, they put it back in the LA Convention Center. All the game demos, the floor was in this one, it was in Concourse Hall, which is this one relatively small room for that building. And so it was still much smaller than 2006. I mean, I think it was a fourth of the size or something like that. But they still had plenty of space, actually had abundant space. It was never crowded in the hallways or anything like that. And you were still able to get around, go to appointments, meet with different companies, and they were all in the same building. And it just made it much, much easier. And then they gradually built it back up until now. E3 it's different than it used to be, but it's a similar size to back in the heyday, and it's very much a big, crazy show now.
Yeah, and it always was going to be, because it's the big look at us event of the year for the video game industry. Mm-hmm. And even at the time when they switched it over in 2006, we realized, like, why would you deliberately cripple your biggest promotional event of the year if you're the industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why there are that many people there is because that many people wanted to be there. And that's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd stop letting in underage guests.
Like TYP. Yes. Well, they have cracked down a little bit since then, but only a little bit.
Right.
But yeah, yep. You were there for the weirdest E3 ever, and I'm really glad we got to hear that story. So, all right, Steven, it's been over 2 hours now. I'm going to cut us off, and thank you so much for your time and for sharing all these memories with me. And thank you, of course, for your service to the website. I mean, you gave more than most to the site, and you did it for a long time. And I really appreciate you sharing the story and for doing everything that you did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we haven't even covered the rest of it. So, you know, if you're ever up for episode 2 of the book interview. But yeah, I mean, I'm very, very glad. I mean, I had more to give. It's just that circumstances didn't allow me to give it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm still around. So, hey, Neil, you're all that retro stuff going. You know, if you need more Planet GameCube people, give me, you know, my number. You got me on Facebook. Let's talk. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it's out there. So thanks again, man. And hopefully I'll get to talk to you again soon and come visit and play some games.
Play some video games.
I'll let you kick my ass in Smash Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
All right, man. See ya.
Yeah. All right, everybody.